Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. The Third World War, the favorite topic for political analysts over the last couple of months, has moved from the realm of speculation into a fast-shaping reality, with Russia announcing partial mobilization in what it sees as a war with NATO and the collective West. Not the war of words, not a proxy war, not the trading of sanctions, but a full-blown kinetic conflict with already thousands of dead on both sides. Can anything be done to prevent further escalation? To discuss that, I'm now joined by Dimitris Konstantakopoulos, political analyst and former advisor to the Greek Prime Minister, Andreas Papandreou. Dimitris, it's a great pleasure, a great honor for me to talk to you. And I really like this opportunity to communicate, because I think we may not have it for a long time, because Russia and Europe seem to be enemies yet again, and those differences seem to be truly irreconcilable. Where do you think it's all heading?
Thank you, first of all, for your invitation. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you and with your public. I'm happy, but I'm unhappy also for the reasons, for the topics we have to discuss today. Because it is true, we are heading, everything indicates that we are heading to a very important crisis. And I would not exaggerate if I would say that this has the potential of threatening even the survival of humanity in different ways, and of its civilization at least. I don't want to be too alarmist, but all indications we have point to this direction on the nuclear level, on the ecological level, and on the economic level.
Well, Dimitris, it's hard to be too alarmist, because I don't know if you follow the Russian news, but the Russian president and his defense minister just the other day characterized the conflict, the operation in Ukraine, as not just a contained regional confrontation, but a full-blown war with NATO and the collective West. And I don't think for them it's a metaphor. It looks like they truly believe that. I wonder if people where you are in Greece also perceive it the same way, that they are at war with Russia.
We are not at war with Russia. Greek, European, Western citizens in general, Western peoples are not in war with Russia. They don't feel like that. This is, it is a lie to say such a thing. What is at war with Russia in an unprecedented, irresponsible, and adventurous way is our ruling classes and our political class. This is different. I really believe that European peoples are for peaceful relations with Russia and for avoiding all this situation. Mm-hmm. And I want to say one thing. Listen, since the beginning of the conflict in Ukraine, and even much before, we are hearing a lot of things about Russia. We are subjected to a 24 hours propaganda war against Russia. I don't want to say that Russia is completely right, or it has not. It should not be criticized. But this is a war propaganda, like the one Europe has. European nations have had during the First and the Second World Wars. In spite of that, in spite of the fact that most European politicians and American politicians are, and public figures in general, are terrorized and they don't want to speak out their real opinion, in spite of the fact that too few politicians are able now to pronounce a critique of the NATO policy, all the polls we have indicate that, if not a majority, an important, a significant minority of European citizens, for example, are against this war. I mean, are against the war launched by NATO against Russia.
Many analysts here in Russia believe that the ultimately, at the core of this crisis is not even the fate of Ukraine, whether it belongs on the East or on the West, but rather a whole confluence of crises, a crisis of capitalism, a crisis of global governance, a crisis of national identities in Russia, in Ukraine, and in the West, as well as the crisis of poor human values. Given your interest in history, do you think humanity has ever faced such a Gordian knot?
No, it's the first so dangerous crisis in the history of humanity. After 1945, we are in possession of means of destruction of unprecedented, we can eliminate life from Earth. On the same time, we have developed new technologies and productive forces which can be used for the profit of humans, but for the time being, they are creating more problems and they are used very often against the interest of humans. So I believe the civilization we had, maybe not only under capitalism, but from the Neolithic revolution till our days, has exhausted its possibilities. Mm-hmm. And we have to invent a new paradigm. Mm-hmm. And the new paradigm cannot be anyway the neoliberal capitalism, which is rapidly evolving to a disaster capitalism, as Naomi Klein has characterized it. I mean, in the past, for example, imperialism, which is the external side of capitalism, was trying to conquer countries. Now they destroy countries, and we have seen this in Yugoslavia, we have seen it in the Middle East, we have seen it in Africa. So it in its quest to preserve its world domination, it has the tendency to become more and more destructive. There are some people... Yes, please.
I'm sorry for interrupting. You mentioned Naomi Klein and her... best-selling book, The Blank Slate, where she provides many examples of how corporate world would drive for wars in various countries to use that as an opportunity to rebuild and sort of propel itself forward, propel its development forward. And, you know, this is the argument I often hear in Russia, that Ukraine is being used as this sort of a sacrificial lamb for the corporations. But is it just Ukraine? Doesn't it go further? Don't you think that it's the entire Europe that the United States is after destroying?
Yes, it is an indirect war against Europe, because with the pretext of the Ukrainian conflict, they impose measures. For example, the sanctions are crippling European economy much more than the Russian economy. In the same time, the possibilities of Europe exercising any sort of independent policy are now nullified. One reason the United States wanted to destroy the relations between the countries of the European Union and Russia, I don't say that the countries of Europe and Russia, because after all, Russia is a part of Europe and quite a large part of Europe, end of European civilization. So they wanted to destroy the relations between the Western Europe and Russia, and this is an important goal of their whole policy on Ukraine, because such relations were a prerequisite for Europe to play an independent role, to stop be the vassal of America. And the whole understanding, and they have written this, the American strategy, the post-Cold War, so-called post-Cold War strategy, was to put an obstacle to any two of the great powers remaining forming alliances, including Europe and Russia and China. They have failed on the level of Russian-Chinese relations, but they have succeeded on the level of European-Russian relations.
Well, at least they have succeeded for now. As we say in Russia, hope dies last. But I agree with you that the Americans are pretty straightforward in asserting that their goal is preserving their economic and political hegemony. They have no qualms about it. They want to preserve the privileges that that hegemony brings to them. And they are ready to sanction or penalize, ostracize any country that disagrees with that. Now, the question, my question to you is whether it's only Russia that disagrees with such an arrangement, because to me it seems to be quite unfair, not only to Russia, but to many of the developing countries, strong developing countries as well.
And also to the popular classes of the developed West, which understand more and more that simply they lack the political subjects which would express their disappointment with American policy and their opposition. By the way, I want to say one remark. It's a nuance, but I would like to tell that I don't believe that this is a question only of American hegemony. We are living in an era of hegemony of international financial capital, of a sort of super imperialism, which has united under its guise all advanced Western countries. And the United States is more a tool than the master of this empire of the finance, of the empire of the money, which wants to dominate the whole world. And this is, of course, a totalitarian project, even if it is hidden behind democratic slogans and democratic ideologies.
Speaking about this sort of drive for hegemony or omnipotence, in his latest speech, Vladimir Putin specifically said that it's in Russia's historic tradition to stop those who aspire to global domination. And in his remarks a few days before that, he even said that, you know, the Americans tend to believe that they are in the place of God, or perhaps even above God. And I think for him, I mean, if you follow his speeches closely, for him, it's a truly ontological issue, you know, to whom the grail belongs, so to say, to quote some Arthurian legend. But this belief that the Americans or the American elites can control the entire human collective, despite all its diversity, despite all its divergent interests, I wonder if that's not against human nature. I mean, in the Greek literature, hubris was considered to be the greatest sin. Is that not hubris to believe that they can do something that only belongs to the domain of the gods?
I think they will not be able to do it. But the problem is that in their effort to do it, they can blow up all the planet. I mean, they don't have the power to dominate the world. This is at least what I believe. And some of their most radical thinkers, like Brzezinski, who was an apostle of imperialism, and who wanted also to dislocate somehow your country, in his last writings, recognized that the window for this unipolar world has closed. They were not able to do it. I think they were believing that China would have its own catastroika. Mm. I use the term catastroika because I believed that the perestroika would be very useful to the Soviet Union, but unfortunately it evolved into catastroika. Mm. So they were hoping, I believe strategically, that they will produce the same kind of transformation in China. Mm. And in the same time, they were hoping that Russia would remain in a state of banania as it was banana republic as it was during Yeltsin's years. So in those both estimations they failed, and now they face the dilemma either to recognize this reality, which is very unpleasant for them, and to try to find a solution of compromises, or to go ahead to adventurist directions which they risk to destroy, really destroy human life.
Well, Dimitris, unlike the Western elites, we have no choice, but we have to take a short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Worlds Apart with Dimitris Konstantakopoulos, political analyst and former advisor to the Greek Prime Minister Andreas Papandreou. Dimitris, before the break, we started talking about globalization. And if we look at the countries that benefited from it a great deal, apart from the West, countries like China, India, South Africa, Brazil, Turkey, they all want more space for themselves. They all want to develop their national identity. They all ask for more sovereignty. And I think if you listen to the speeches of their leaders, they approach sovereignty not as some abstract political concept, as a way of resisting the United States, but as a way of governing. You know, you need to make fast, efficient decisions very quickly to serve your people in these very unpredictable times without waiting for Uncle Sam to do his calculus and, you know, give you what you're supposed to do. Isn't hegemony, regardless who is on top, antithetical to the very nature of the times we live in?
Listen, I believe that we need more than ever in human history, we need international cooperation. Because the world now more than ever is facing a lot of different problems, which will be impossible to be solved by any country or even any region of the world. So it is important to combine the resistance to the unipolar world, to imperialism, with a vision, with a message, which will be attractive to all people of the world, including Russian society, Ukrainian society, Western Europe, America, and the south of our planet. We have, because for the time being, what we see is more reaction than action, more negation of the Western order than proposal of a new world order. I mean, the forces which rightly are defending in a way democracy, because this is a strange thing now. The West is saying that they are defending democracy, they want to propagate democracy, etc. But as my friend Mikis Theodorakis was saying, the fact that Russia and China exist permit to all of us to breathe, because otherwise this terrible force which came out of the unipolar moment of 1991 would dominate all humanity, and this would be bad also for Americans themselves, you see, because this would be a total totalitarian regime for them also. So those forces are very I understand that they want to defend against this unipolarity. I find it more or less positive. Of course, there are aspects which one can agree or disagree, but in the total, it is positive. What is lacking still, it's a new vision which can unite the nations of the world.
Well, to some extent, this vision is very simple, leave and let leave. You know, there's been so much talk about a win-win game on the Western side. But I think if we are truly fair and analytical, we will see that the whole strategy of the Western civilization so far has been to get resources from everywhere else and saddle them with the sense of inferiority and dependence on the Western largesse, on the Western wisdom, and try to penalize those who disagree. Because what strikes me the most is this the belief on the part of many Americans and the Europeans that the global economy belongs to them. It's up to them to decide who can participate in that. Isn't that in and of itself you know, the kind of dystopia that is quite fascist? I mean, if you look deep down at it, you know, deciding that certain nations are not supposed to participate in the global trade and in the work of the global family.
But the question is that what you say, it is the norm of the capitalist system. I mean, capitalism goes by its nature to concentrate more and more power and more resources. And in the same time, to deny those resources to other people, to other entities. So what I say is that we have to replace the system and its civilization, which is still dominating the world. We have to find some other way to organize our economic and social relations and some other way to some other civilization. Because what is happening, it's symptomatic of deepest tendencies. It's not a mistake. It is not that one American president made a mistake or another miscalculation. It's the normal tendency of the system, which is the still dominant system, dominant in both economic terms and ideological, civilizational, psychological terms. So we have to replace it with something else.
But there's also no escape of the recognition that that system is failing. It's not able to govern. And we've seen the pandemic, for example, and the response to the pandemic, which was pretty selfish and disastrous on the part of the richest countries. And I think the bluff has been called a couple of years ago. Now, my question to you is, what do you think will make these people, these elites, recognize that they can get by with less? Why do they need to strive for dominance, even when it comes to hurt them themselves? I mean, as you mentioned, the Western societies are suffering. These standards of living are falling. If you look at the rates of depression, suicide, obesity, what have you, people are living poorer, less happier lives. So what keeps them going when the returns are not so great anymore?
Listen, more and more, the latest polls in the United States say that a majority of American young people, they would like a socialist regime. Most of them, they have not read any socialist newspaper or any book or any, they are not acquainted with that. What they want to say with this is that they are understanding that the capitalist system has failed, and they need an alternative. They are using the word socialism, socialist, because this is making clear the opposition, and they are young people, so they don't have the memories of the Soviet Union, of all the discussions of the demise of the Soviet Union, and they express this. But they don't have any political subject able to advance their agenda. What they have, because you understand, on the other hand, who is ruling the world? It is the president of Goldman Sachs. You said before about gods in that Americans are behaving like gods. Lloyd Blankfein, who was the head of Goldman Sachs, has said so much. He said sometimes we must do the work of gods. It is another one, is the man who rule Exxon, who rule Lockheed Martin, who rule all those institutions. Do you think that these guys are, if for example, the president of Exxon would say that I will stop the new investments in fossil fuel extraction to help address the climatic change, the next day he would be in prison, assassinated, or in a madhouse. They are the rulers of the world, but in reality they are ruled themselves by all those corporate machines that have been created.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you here something I think that is very pertinent to this question, because you've written a lot about the cult of unlimited individualism, which sees any social, national, religious, or ideological identity as inimical to itself. And I would add that it also sells to people the rhetoric of freedom while enslaving them to all sorts of dependencies. Now, hard times always bring people together. There is a tendency on the part of humans to sort of seek safety in the community, to come together when times are tough. Isn't that one of the silver linings of the current crisis? Perhaps the renewed sense of the common identity, of the collective identity.
Yes, that is true. That is a force which can be used for good and for bad purposes. For instance, this force has been used in the 30s to collect public support for Nazism and fascism in Germany and Italy. People were believing that by voting National Socialists, they would save Germany and in the same time advance towards socialist society. This was crazy, but still it has worked. But also nationalism can be a very positive force in some cases, especially in cases that a nation is oppressed and it is defending its identity, its existence. We cannot put all nationalism in the same basket, because this is a phenomenon which can be used in very different and opposite ways. You know, I remember having read a Soviet writer who is now maybe a little bit forgotten, but I think he has written very important books. So he says that Bormann had this idea when the Third Reich was collapsing. He had the idea, he said that the mistake of German Nazism was that it was too German. It was a project which could not succeed because nobody, all of humanity would not be ready to. And so he wanted to prepare for a new kind of fascism where a conglomeration of nationalisms would appear and would try to impose a dictatorship on the world. I believe this is, I rather tend to believe that this is a true project which was created at the end of the Nazi regime. And we must not forget that the bulk of Nazi services and a lot of their apparatus was has been integrated into American and West German services and deep states. So those things are important to understand. There is a continuation. Bandera, for example, in Ukraine, they have used him, and now we see his descendants, like the Azov Battalion and the right sector in Ukraine.
We have to leave it there. I really appreciate your time today and wish you peace of mind and being to you and to all of us.
Thank you very much for the invitation and for the opportunity to discuss with you. It was for me also very interesting.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again next week on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.